Okay, where do I begin? I promise to only bore you to the extent of your interest. So if you do have questions, and if I know the answers, I will give them to you. If not, we can be done in maybe 20 to 30 minutes. I must begin by thanking Father for having me. It's very generous and welcoming of you and very kind to open your church to a stranger, basically. And I very much appreciate it. I need to say that. So thank you. Thank you to your parish council or whoever was involved in agreeing to this invitation. I also need to make something clear from the very beginning, because I want all of us to be calm and relaxed for this half an hour or 40 minutes that we have together. I am not here to get your money. I want that out of the way, entirely. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't appreciate help. It doesn't mean that if you can, I'm not accepting it. But that's not why I'm here. I am here for the same reason that God pushed me into this mad project concerning the monastery, because I want you to find out more about the saints of these islands. I don't know a lot about them, so do not expect a historian. I don't know a lot about them. I've not studied them in a practical way in a university. I've simply learned of them because life more or less forced me to learn about them. In 2009, the beginning of 2010, when I first found out about the church that has become now our monastery church, I knew nothing about the Celtic saints. I knew of St. Cuthbert and St. Bede because I had studied for some years in Durham. And in Durham, in the northeast of England, there's a big, beautiful Norman cathedral where the relics of St. Bede and St. Cuthbert are to this day. So I knew of those two because of that very reason. But I knew nothing else. At some point, God just brought this church into my life. I said yes to it. And then I had to find out. I mean, when you travel to Mull, where on earth is Mull? And then you find out about Iona, and you see so many people going there. Why do they go there? And then you find out about St. Columba, and you wonder, well, I've been Romanian all my life, I've been Orthodox all my life, I've never heard of St. Columba. Is he male? Is she female? I mean, Columba could be anything. And that's how slowly, step by step, I've learned about these saints. God has blessed this project immensely. And I feel my only duty really is to educate you at least to the extent that I am educated about these saints. I want you to leave from here today and know just that there are some islands somewhere to the west of Scotland, and that sometime in the first millennium there was a flourishing church in those isles which was in full community with the Orthodox Church. If you remember this, I'm happy. That's what I wanted to achieve. Thank you again. And if you have any questions while I go through these photographs, just stop me and ask me. It's better to ask then, because then by the end of it, you will just have forgotten and, you know, we'll all be asleep. And by the way, if I do yawn through my own presentation, I've only slept for 4 hours last night. So it's partly my own boredom, partly just being very tired. I ask for your forgiveness. Okay, what I will do is I'll start with a few photographs, I think, concerning, the United Kingdom itself. Many of you have traveled to Europe. Some of you, at least Elizabeth and also Colin, have been to Mull itself. So you will have some idea about the British Isles. But for those of you who don't, this is the United Kingdom. It incorporates this big island called Great Britain and the north of this smaller island called Ireland. So the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. This is the Republic of Ireland itself. The area we are interested in is actually Scotland, which is pretty much north of these mountains. And you'll see that in Scotland there are lots of islands all around. There's the Shetlands to the north, the Orkneys, and then the Hebrides. The Hebrides, or the Western Isles, is where most of what we call the Celtic saints have lived in the first millennium. And let's also get this out of the way. When we talk about Celtic Christianity, or the Celtic Church, or the Celtic saints, these are all concepts we have made up. They did not exist back then. There's no such thing as the institution of the Celtic Church. There is no such thing as a Celtic Christianity described, you know, through their own canons or different theology. We use these words to refer to the saints who lived in these isles, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and by extension, you could include England and parts of Western Europe as well. Celtic basically means those on the outside. That's what it means, the literal meaning of the word. Keltoi, it sounds like a bad joke, comes from Greek, like all words. And it literally means those on the outside of the Roman Empire. Because these were the only people at one point who had not been occupied by the Roman Empire. They were known as the last free ones for that very reason. And to this day, if you go to Newcastle, you can see Adrian's Wall. It's as far north, Newcastle is here, it's as far north as the Roman Empire managed to get. They could never conquer Scotland or the Isles. So here, in these Isles, to the Isle of Mull, on the Isle of Mull, is where in 2010, at the beginning, God pretty much placed a church into my lap. I did have to say yes. It wasn't by force, so it's my fault as well. But I did say yes to something I didn't know much about. In my mind, I was a monastic already I was entering my sixth year of being a monk, and I was looking and searching and praying for a place which would be as remote and secluded as possible, because that's the sort of place and the sort of prayer I feel still drawn to. And I still remember receiving the phone call from the parish priest in Glasgow telling me that there is an abandoned church on the Isle of Mull. Nobody wants it because it's on the western side of the island. It's where all the storms that we get from America, thank you very much, hit and ruin everything. Anybody normal lives on the eastern side of the island. And that's the case with all the isles. The monks were all on the west for reasons that have to do with their own spirituality and the way they perceived, you know, a relationship to death and nature and God himself. So nobody wanted that church. It's far away. It was falling apart. And there are three houses close to us. You can't make a parish with, you know, three houses. And probably, well, certainly, they are not Orthodox, if they are Christian at all. So the only use this church could have is that of a monastery. And I remember receiving the phone call and saying yes, just to this idea of a far away, remote place on an island. And then what you know, I had to find out. I knew nothing, again, about any of these saints. So on the Isle of Mull, we actually have two places. We are based in two places. Kilninian, which doesn't mean go and kill Ninian. It's actually the Church of Saint Ninian. And those who've traveled to Scotland, you must have seen Kill Patrick or Kill Brandon or Kill Bridget and all these kills, Kill Martin. That tiny little word, kill, generated the word kirk and then church in English. It's the Church of Saint Ninian. It's built, the building we do have now, is built in 1755 but the foundations of the monastery go back to late 6th century, beginning of the 7th century. And I'll show you, there are visible ruins everywhere on the hills surrounding Kilninian. So that's where the church is. Unfortunately, I have failed until now to either build something, some sort of accommodation there, or to buy one of those three houses, because they are not on the market until this January. I'll tell you more about it later. So to live on the island, we actually bought a house in Bunessan, which sounds very weird because the church is there, but the house is here. Well, we've done that because in the long run, this will become our pilgrimage center. And it's very well positioned for that because that's where Iona, the holy island, is located. We are less than 15 minutes away from Iona. And from Finnefort, the port to Iona, is where you get the boats to Inchkenneth, Alva, Gometra, Langa, Staffa, all these islands that have connections or roots back into the Celtic times. This is the view from in front of Kilninian itself. I wanted you to see how close the water actually is to us. And it's positioned in this ancient cemetery that goes back to the original monastery. So some of those graves will go back to the late 500s. And this is the church itself, as it looks after we've restored it and basically entirely repaired the roof. This little building here, or the ruins of it, is very important. That's known, it's actually on the map, as the hermit's cell. The very first hermit who came from Iona to live on this site lived there. His cell was there. And around him, the monastery grew until it became a proper monastic dwelling. And the church, as I said, the church we have now is built in 1755. The entire history on that site began with this little humble well or spring known as the Well or the Spring of St. Ninian. And that is mentioned as early as the 400s. It honors St. Ninian, who is a Celtic saint who lived in the 4th century, so the 300s, and is absolutely vital to the history of monasticism in Scotland. The oldest, so the first monastery in Scotland we know of, is founded by him, and goes back to 397. That is the 4th century, just when the very first monasteries were beginning to be built in Egypt itself. Perfectly contemporary with Christianity and monasticism in Egypt. And because St. Ninian traveled to the Isles, we don't know exactly where, but we know that he did travel to the Isles to bring Christianity there. There are places on some islands dedicated to him. And this well, this spring, to this day is known as St. Ninian's Well. And because of the presence of this well, that first hermit came from Iona and settled. And because of that, you know, the whole history of the monastery began. And we do go there and we sprinkle our pilgrims and we bless them with our water. And whenever something will be built there, that will be our source of water, which is a blessing in itself. We had to, as a side note, we had to take all sorts of tests, water quality tests for our planning applications. And then they send these tests and they come back to you telling you what sort of filters you need, depending what, you know, they find in the spring. And ours came back with no filter required. Because it actually is a spring just there. It doesn't come from anywhere else. There's no, you know, animal to get it dirty. And this is an aerial view. It's purposely black and white. They are done professionally black and white. It's taken from a helicopter. I didn't do that. I wouldn't have the funds to do that. And it's taken in November, December, when the vegetation is died out. If you notice, there are no leaves in the trees. Because that's when, if you pay attention, you perceive the circles in the hills around, which are all covered through the summer See how perfectly round they are? They're all covered by ferns and absolutely invisible. But when the vegetation is dead and you take black and white photographs from high above, they are perfectly visible. And those are the places where the first monastics, those in the early centuries, built those, they call them beehives, but it has nothing to do with bees. It's actually an igloo-like sort of structure built of stone, which were used as monastic cells. And there's a very good reason why they are built on the hill, because down there, there's a valley. And in the valley, obviously, the risk of flooding is very high. So they would put their cells up on the hills. I included two photographs, just so you know what we've been doing. Apart from taking care of the church, we've actually had to completely replace the roof of the church. We had to take it entirely down. The church was covered with just black plastic for about a year and a half, close to 2 years, while we took down all the, how do you call those things? Slates, the stone slates, and also the timber structure. Because we discovered when we went inside that that was the original timber from 1700s. And as good as that timber could have been, you know, every 2, 3, 4 centuries, you do have to replace it, especially when you live in a wet place like Scotland. By the way, do you remember there was an island in front of our graveyard, so to say? It's still there somewhere, but this is a typical July day. I thought I should point that out. The fog just covers everything. So for 1 year and a half, that's what we had.
Father, when you say we, you're referring to yourself and...
I'm referring to every single poor soul who gave me $1. Because myself alone, I couldn't have done any of this. Any, not even the physical work. I was telling Colin, I can't even change a bulb. You know, we all have our own strength, our own weaknesses. I'm practically speaking, I'm amazed I'm still alive. I'm not electrocuting myself every single day. But with help, all of this has been... To say that I've done that would be very presumptuous and very proudful of me. And
so volunteers.
Volunteers for the funds, not volunteers for the work. Because at the house that we have close to Iona, we can do the work ourselves. We could all go there and build a chapel. Here, this entire area of Mull is listed as an outstanding area of natural beauty, which is a national reservation in America. And also the site itself is listed as a heritage site. So there's nothing you can do there yourself. Only professional builders who have the right to work on such sites are allowed to go in. And of course, they are dearer, as we say in Britain. Anyway, this is what I've had to deal with for the first 2 years of my life with this monastery. Because of the trees, really. A storm in 2013 broke the trees down. They fell on the roof, and I thought, oh, it's going to be easy. They were just here. These trees have been cut now. They broke this area of the roof, and I thought we'll just have to cover that. But then, of course, when we discovered that the timber work was rotten, you had to do the whole thing. And what made it even more difficult and more expensive is that because it is a historical building, they do not allow you to buy new tiles. You have to actually have 18th century tiles used there. So how on earth do you get, you know, 18th century tiles? I can't travel back in time and buy them. The only way to do it is to travel from place to place, from island to island, until you find other buildings from that century that have fallen into ruin and are beyond repair, and you collect the tiles that they still have. And you get 20 from there, 50 from there, until you have enough for the entire roof. I was always wondering before I needed it, why they still have them. Why don't you just kind of throw them? Because you need them. This is just a little map of the church. This is the church itself. This is where the well is. And this here is a piece of land that, again, we bought. It's 5 acres of land. I wanted to make sure, first of all, that nothing will get built there in the future. And if anything gets built, it's our initiative. And these are the three houses that I mentioned are anywhere close to the church. This house went on the market in January. And we've actually put an offer on it. And I'm still praying, by the grace of God, if everything goes okay, by Pascha, we should actually own that, which would be amazing. It came in a very bad moment financially, but God helped because I found people that who lent me the money. In Romanian, you have just one word for both, and I'm always... So they lent the money so we can purchase that. But that would be ideal because then this would be the church as it's supposed to be. I and any future community would live in this house. It has 3 bedrooms. But, you know, if there are more people, I can just sleep in the church or something. And then we can use the house we have close to Iona as our pilgrimage house to generate the funds to repay the loan on that house. So by the grace of God, as long as, you know, I'm healthy and God continues to bless us, things should be okay. This, everything I've shown you, happens here. The house with the pilgrimages is located here, and I've included, this is the village of Bunesen. It's an entirely different area, and this is not considered an area of outstanding natural beauty. I purposely included this photograph. This is boring and uninteresting. And this is the house, the pilgrimage house. This is not photoshopped. We do have a colony of seals in front of the house. So they come there when they have their pups. You can see that inside there, there's like a small bay. And it's protected and they really like that. We have a lot of neighbors, as you can see. And we get along marvelously with all of them. And this is where we base our pilgrimages through the summer. And with that, this is a small shed behind the house, which we now have turned into a little chapel. This is something that I was telling you that can be done physically with volunteers because we are no longer in the reservation area. So 4 people from the parish of Father Anthony Carbo in Colorado Springs, 3 wonderful people came, and in about a week to 10 days, they turned the shed into this little chapel. Everything is wood on the inside, and that's where we have our daily services and everything else. Okay, that's the monastery, and I had to show you that so you know who I am and why I'm here. What I'll do now, briefly, and please, again, if you have a question, stop me. I'll take you through, I think there are 3 or 4 saints who lived very close to Mal or on Mal itself. And I will show you the places connected with them on the islands nearby. The first of them is Saint Brandon the Navigator. And the reason he is the first and not Saint Columba, as most people would expect probably, is that in fact Saint Brandon made it to the Hebrides about 2 decades before St. Columba. In 541, St. Brandon had already built a monastery on an island nearby, whereas St. Columba came over only in 563, so 22 years later. From Mull, I'll always go back to this map so you have kind of a visual representation. From Mull, you have to take a motor boat from this little bay, and you go out, and you go all the way down here. And this island is known in Gaelic, I mean the translation is, the rocky place of the saint. And that's where Saint Columba, Saint Brandon, built his monastery. Why did I include this? I shouldn't have, because it will scare the life out of you. This is how you get from the motorboat to the actual island. So you can look at Elizabeth's excited face. She survived it twice. So you get from the motorboat into this inflatable dinghy, as they are called, and then you just land here. But it's beautiful. That's actually where the monks themselves would have landed. And there still is a place with the foundation of this huge, it must have been at least 6 to 7 meter high Celtic cross, meeting everyone, welcoming everyone on the island. It was taken down at the Reformation, but that's the usual story. This is the view of the ruins of the monastery. The island is entirely abandoned and has been uninhabited for close to 6 centuries now. This marks the place of the old first millennium Celtic cemetery, and this is where, by tradition, St. Columba's mother is buried, St. Ithne. He did not bury her on Iona, because Iona was an exclusively male island at the time, like Athos today. So he took her to the monastery of St. Brendan. And what you see behind are the ruins of the Benedictine monastery, which was put there in the 14th century, built there. This chapel, which looks tiny, but it's actually taller than I am, it's about kind of up to here still, dates back to the first millennium, late 900s. And it's quite extraordinary that what goes back to the first millennium is in better shape than what was built in the 14th century. And the reason for that, again, I don't know these things, so I ask everybody. The advantage of asking when you don't know is that you learn. And someone who was actually a builder and a pilgrim of ours told me that in the first millennium, they did not use any mortar. They just had stone on stone, so that never changes. Whereas in the 14th century, the Catholic monastics used mortar. And in time, that's eaten away by the humidity and the wind. And when it does, what used to be like 2 stones like that will fall down, and then the whole structure will eventually collapse. I had never considered that. But the most important thing on the island are the beehives. Because here, not being inhabited for so many centuries, they still survive. On Mull and on Iona and on the other islands, and people took the stone and used it as building material for their own homes. But here, because nobody lives, you still have the beehives, almost complete. 2 of them, which are actually a double beehive structure, you can see they are united through a sort of a door between them. These 2 are dated to the time when St. Brendan lived on the island. And because only the abbot of a monastery would have use for a double beehive, you know, one for yourself and one for your confessions or whatever advice you offer, we know certainly that that's where St. Brendan himself lived, which is unique to know in a historical sort of way that this is where a saint has lived. And every time we go there, this is another view of the beehive. Every time we go there, if the weather allows us, we try to celebrate a divine liturgy, which is an amazing, amazing experience to be standing in St. Brendan's cell celebrating the divine liturgy. Everything is, you know, improvised. We have to carry everything on our backs, and it's quite difficult. You have all sorts of dangers, like the seagulls, for instance, who all of a sudden become very interested in our communion. So I need 1 or 2 pilgrims to keep watch and become guardians. Or the rain, it happened twice. Beautiful sky, blessed is the kingdom, and 2 minutes later it's pouring with rain. But by the grace of God, now we have a solution. We have umbrellas with us. So what we end up doing is you basically have an umbrella at the center and then other people around until you rebuild the beehive with umbrellas. And it's so beautiful because then I, as a priest, have these bodies all around me. And everybody is just there with you. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. About 22 years after St. Brendan arrived to his island, St. Columba arrived to Iona. Well, he's better known. Who here knows a bit about the life of St. Columba? Just so I know if I have to... Okay. Well, briefly put, he was Irish. Well, all of them were Irish. All of them came from Ireland. And because of... Most probably because of an argument that he had with his spiritual father in Ireland, he was forced into exile. And he felt so repentant about what had happened that he took it upon himself not only to leave Ireland, but to travel as far north as necessary as to no longer be able to see his home country. So it was only once he arrived to Iona, which is here, he was coming from Ireland, which would be here somewhere. Looking back, he could no longer see Ireland. So they settled, he and his companions settled there. This is known to this day as St. Columba's Bay. It's a beautiful day pilgrimage to cross Iona from one side to the other and to get to this bay and just, you know, pray to the saint. We say the canon to St. Columba there. And within the bay, this is the bay, there's this hill which again is marked to even our contemporary maps as the hill of the turning back to Ireland. Because by tradition, St. Columba climbed on top of that hill and looked back to make sure that his penitence was complete and home was no longer visible. That's why that hill is marked. This is the abbey on Iona. The entire building dates from the late 19th, early 20th century. So it's quite recent, built in early 1900s. But the foundations, the position of the abbey is where the original Celtic monastery existed. And just for your kind of sense of perspective, this is all on Iona, and that is Mull. So that's what you have to cross from Mull to get to St. Columba's Island. This is the view from the sea, and that tiny little thing there, that's actually important. It marks the place of the highest hill on Iona called Dun E. And this is where the previous inhabitants of Iona, the pagans there, performed their human sacrifices. And the same things happened on Mull and all the islands nearby. And these highest places are marked as the places of human sacrifice. This is the only high Celtic cross surviving on Iona to this day in its original position. It's dedicated to St. Martin. There were apparently in the first millennium over 300 of them on the entire island. Probably they used them the way we use our calendars. So they had one cross dedicated to each saint of the day. Most of them were taken down at the Reformation and either used as building material or simply thrown in the seas nearby, which was the better option because then they could kind of salvage them later on. The reason why they took them down was that they are and were and still are covered with icons. If you pay attention, it's not very good, the resolution, but actually there is the Mother of God holding child. If this, for instance, these are two lions with Daniel. And every single layer, there's another icon all the way down. And for that reason, they took them down. There are three others that survive in the museum on Iona because they found them, bits and pieces, in the waters nearby. The most important of which is actually this one. It's known as St. John's Cross. I'm actually wearing a replica of that. And it is perhaps the most important because it's the very first, in terms of age, visual image that we have of the Celtic cross. And it was found in the waters. And as you can see, you know, it's not complete, but they do know where the other bits and pieces would have gone. That is a wonderful, wonderful museum on Iona. St. Oran is another saint from Iona, and I include him because St. Columba, actually, even in his lifetime, did not receive anyone in an audience for confession or advice until they went and prayed where St. Oran had been built. And I feel I have to present him. And also, I love him personally very much. He's one of my my saints, and I entrust my own salvation to him with full confidence. So I want him to be better known. He is looking in this icon into a grave, into a tomb, because the story of his life is quite drastic in a way. Once they started to build the first chapel on Iona, St. Columba and his other monks, they realized that soon after, whatever they built was falling down, was collapsing. And this happened again and again, until St. Columba had a vision of one of the local gods, a demon, in which the demon told him, nothing on Iona is established without human sacrifice. Back to that image. Which, of course, I mean, how do you kill somebody as a Christian in order to build a church? Which, in a way, is a very ironic question to ask, looking back at Christ. But anyway, he and the other monastics were getting ready to leave the island and look for another place, until Saint Oran, who was the oldest among them, that's why he's depicted like that, offered to be buried alive as the foundation upon which to build the first Christian church on Iona. And that first Christian church is a very basic structure, which is this one. And pay attention to this. Out of everything that was built on the Holy Island through all those centuries, the great abbey, all those hundreds of Celtic crosses, out of everything that was built there, that first chapel is the only one, the only building on Iona that still stands from the first millennium. Everything else was taken down, everything else was rebuilt, you know, a millennium later. This, the foundation of the very first church built on the relics of St. Oran, is the only building whose foundations, parts of the walls, go actually back to the Celtic millennium. So when people tell me about sacrifice, I always think about that. Whatever you do with sacrifice, God receives and is never lost.
Is Oran the same as Ronan?
I don't know. Very simply put.
There's a chapel of Ronan right in Iona, so I was wondering.
It's very possible, because they have so many versions of their names. All the names that we know, really, Columba, for instance, is a deformed, like the 10th version of the original name. St. Hilda, for instance, was St. Hild, and it became Hilda because it had to be a Roman name, and God only knows what's the original name. So it could be, but rather than offering you, you know, the wrong information, I'd rather just say, I don't know. The cemetery itself is the old monastic cemetery. And again, in the church, as we try to do everywhere, we celebrate the divine liturgy. We have a lot of help from these things here. You can see the presence of birds in very unpleasant ways. They sing with us, which is wonderful. They really do. The minute we start singing, I think they are so surprised that they just start singing. But out of excitement, sometimes they do other things as well. So again, umbrellas can be very useful, just in case we get a blessing, particularly in that area. And just before we end with Iona, I must mention the Holy Martyrs, because all these islands where there was a monastery or an abbey of sorts or just a hermit in a cave, all of them ended up being martyred when the Vikings, the series of Viking attacks started very early on, actually, surprisingly early on, in the 7th, 8th century. And eventually that's what, you know, led to the complete abandonment of these isles. This is known as the Martyr's Bay, and this is known as the White Strand of the Monks. They are the two places of the biggest, most vicious attacks that took place. On Martyr's Bay, 68 monks were killed in one single attack. 68 of them. And the icon that I showed at the very beginning is actually dedicated to them. And the bay in the icon is Martyrs Bay. They did not rise or didn't put up any fight. They did not oppose that fate in any way. And again, think back. We are talking about the 600s. Those are not people like me. I probably would have been a sort of a snack for them. These were men who were built to live in the Celtic Isles at a time when there was hardly any food available, hardly any heating even conceivable, no glass, you know, in your windows, and you're left entirely to your own devices and to the mercy of God and nature. And yet, out of those 68 men, not one fought back. They all died. They're all just erased. But the results of that are that, first of all, they are now in our calendars. They have a feast day in July, the Holy Martyrs of Iona, so their salvation. And also, once the Vikings were shocked by this, and they saw that again and again, everywhere they went, these potentially scary men never fought back. That's what converted them to Christianity. Because that didn't fall into any sort of logic of their own culture. And that's how Christianity ended up converting the Scandinavians. There are ways in which when you follow God's will and God's commandments, even if apparently you've failed here and everything has collapsed, the seed you planted just by being obedient to Christ will have some fruit somewhere else, maybe a century later. And this story is just the best example of that. Never look for results. The only thing that concerns us is to follow His commandments, not whether or not they may work. That's just a silly way to get around them. And this is in the museum on Iona, and it is a mass burial gravestone, which for me is the most touching holy object on Iona. It's the only one that has multiple crosses on them, and they are very simple crosses. They don't have any of the fancy, typical Celtic motifs, because when close to 70 of your community are killed in one day, you don't have the time to build a nice monument for all of them. You just put all those bodies in one grave and you cover them with something like that. And that, for me, is from another world entirely. That was Iona. Before we move to Mull, the last saint I want you to know of is Saint Kenneth, who lived on a tiny little island called Inchkenneth. Inchkenneth means the tiny island of Kenneth, in a cave overlooking the Isle of Mull again. So this is the Isle of Mull. Saint Kenneth was one of the 12 monks who came to Iona with Saint Columba, but a few years after they landed there, he felt a calling for a much more secluded, withdrawn, silent type of monastic life. So he moved from Iona to this tiny little island called today Inchkenneth, the island of Kenneth. And he lived in a cave. This is the landing on Inchkenneth, and these are the mountains of Mull. Again, very, very close to us. And we get there with our pilgrimages. That's why that boat is there. It's a sailing boat. We sail from Iona all the way to Inchkenneth, the way they would have done it. And there was something I wanted to tell you. I just thought about it. Oh, yes. The only reason that that boat is there is because of the pilgrimage. Nobody else goes to the island where St. Brandon has lived and where those monasteries are. Nobody else gets to St. Kenneth's Island. We are the only ones. And that's why everywhere we go, you might ask yourself, why do you celebrate there if it could rain? Because if we don't, nobody else will, and nobody else has since the end of the Celtic millennium. So it's important to try everything, even if it's difficult, even if it's risky, just get a divine liturgy done. Because that links us back to them. These are the ruins of the old, again, Benedictine monastery with their chapel over there. And we at least say a canon and a prayer if we cannot celebrate the liturgy. It's a place where some of the best kept graves of the MacLeans, the MacLean family, are kept on Inchkenneth. And then from the monastery, from the church, if you go down into the valley and you kind of walk around the coast for a while, all of a sudden you see the cave, which is St. Kenneth's cave. He lived personally as a hermit in the cave. And then, just like the hermit at our monastery at Kilninian, around him other people came, and slowly a community was built up. And we do go in there, and what I like to pray in that particular cave is St. Patrick's breastplate, which is a most wonderful prayer. I know it's very common in the Protestant church. Don't stay away from it just because the Protestants are using it. It is a wonderful, wonderful prayer, and it dates back to the first millennium. It's our prayer. And when you pray it in a cave, it mentions the stones and the storms and the sea and the air. You realize how present nature was in their lives. When you read it in your home, it's a bit theoretical, but when you're there, it all just comes to life.